Well, good evening, everyone. Here in the Zendo and out there in the world of Zoom, near and far, good to see you all. Well, I think we're in week 6 of our 8-week practice period. For those of you who are new, this is something we do every year in the fall. For a span of about 8 weeks, we just kind of intensify and strengthen our practice. And each person makes a personal commitment to what that's going to look like for them. And we end with our Loon Lake Sesshin, or week-long retreat that will be coming up starting next Saturday. So we have been exploring this year the theme of right relationship. You know, in the Eightfold Path, we have that the Buddha taught, we have right view, right intention, right speech, right livelihood, right conduct, right effort, right concentration, and right mindfulness. All those rights. And right doesn't mean right as opposed to wrong, so much as good, wholesome ways of living your life in this world that are, you know, beneficial instead of harmful to yourself and others. So right in that sense, right in terms of in good alignment, you know, with our best intentions. And right relationship isn't on that list, but in a sense, each one of those parts of the Eightfold Path support right relationship. And we chose right relationship because of the months and months of relative isolation that we've all experienced. And as we're coming to this stage in this experience of the pandemic, we're kind of re-engaging in person more. And it's not necessarily so easy. Some people are more cautious about that, and some are just, let's go party. And workplaces have changed. I'm hearing so many people that workplaces have been stressful and changed. So, a lot of strain in relationships. So we've been talking about relationships at every level, starting from our relationship with ourselves, our own body, mind, family, community, workplace, sort of in expanding circles of connection. And there's one aspect that I've been interested in for a long time. Ever since, over 20 years ago, I took a course in systems theory. And that's the relationships between complex systems, or how those systems influence and are influenced by each other. So what I mean when I say complex relationship, there's complex systems, or what I also call world systems, are systems that, because they're systems that interconnect worldwide, as an aside, I've always thought it's been kind of funny that the term World Wide Web was coined for the internet. I don't know who did it, but or how long ago, but it always has struck me as funny, because the Buddhist image of Indra's net predated it by, you know, some 2,000 years. For those of you who may not have heard of Indra's net, it's the model of the universe in Buddhist thinking, whereby the vast net throughout multi-dimensional space and time, and at every node on the net of crossing, there's a jewel that reflects every other jewel in the net. So if you touch one jewel or do something to one jewel, it affects all the others. It's sort of a holographic model, really. Anyway, beats the internet. But simply put, general systems theory is a sort of interdisciplinary study of interrelated systems with the aim of understanding their workings and applying those understandings in beneficial ways, hopefully. And it originated out of the search to find a way to understand scientifically phenomena that could not be explained by a simple mechanistic model. The mechanistic model says that the whole is simply the sum of the parts. And systems theory says that the whole is more than the system of the sum of the parts. The whole is an interactive process, which is called synergy, right? The interactions of the parts, or interactions of systems. Dynamic relationships. So there are what we might call natural systems. Our body is one, right? Our body is a system composed of systems. Digestive, circulatory, nervous, etc. It's a living system, it's an open system that maintains and organizes itself by exchanging matter, energy, and information with its environment. These flow through the system and are transformed by it. So this body that we have, a system made up of systems, is also is interacting with multiple other systems, right? Food systems, energy systems, right? Social systems, political systems. This description comes from a book by Joanna Macy called Mutual Causality in Buddhism and General Systems Theory, which I read a long time ago, subtitled The Dharma of Natural Systems. And that's her academic study where she links systems theory with the Buddhist teaching of Patika Samuppada, which means mutual causality. So on a larger scale than our body, there are ecosystems, right? Weather systems, human constructed systems, economic, government, healthcare. And in earlier times in human history, and when we lived on a village scale or a small tribal scale, limited by geographical factors and means of transportation, we were kind of in very direct relationship to those systems. We knew the source of our food or our energy, you know, what heated our homes, what we exchanged with our neighbors. But as we all know, now the scale of interrelating systems is global. And I think the realization of the implications and the perils of global systems in our world is what prompted Joanna Macy's lifelong commitment to engage Buddhist practice. For those who don't know her name, she's one of the most important Buddhist thinkers and activists of our time, and I think maybe still a little underappreciated outside of those circles, because she's not identified primarily as a Buddhist teacher. She doesn't have the same stature as famous Buddhist teachers, but her work has been incredibly important. And in her non-academic work, for a general readership, World as Lover, World as Self, from 1991, I'm going to read to you in a minute her words, but she elaborates the kind of groundwork for her work that she called or developed over the previous decade, called Despair and Empowerment Work. Despair and Empowerment Work, which she often did in group workshops for people to connect to their deepest feelings about the state of the world. And from that, be empowered to take action. She's changed in more recent years the name of that, what she calls that work, to the work that reconnects. So instead of the stress on despair, it's on work that reconnects, reestablishes connections to our own lives and to the world. She says, no philosophic tenet has more impact on me than Patika Samuppada, mutual causality, confirming an intuitive sense I've always felt of the interconnectedness of all things. This doctrine has provided me with ways to understand the intricate web of co-arising that links one being with all others, and to apprehend the reciprocities between thought and action, self and world. It has led me to see that even my pain for the world is a function of this mutual belonging, like a cell experiencing the larger body. Because it shows that causality or power resides in relationships rather than in persons or institutions, it offers the courage to resist conformity and to act in new ways to change the situation. So she's seeing a freedom in this realization of mutuality, right? Interrelationship. Possibilities for choice, new choices. But as we all know, I think, when we open to the magnitude and the complexity of world systems, we can easily feel overwhelmed. Anybody feel that at times, right? You know? But her work over 5 decades has been about bringing people together in community to connect, encourage, and empower each other, to speak and act from their deepest place of caring for the earth and all beings. In other words, to live as bodhisattvas. So I thought what I wanted to do this evening is take a kind of case study in world systems and then apply some of Joanna Macy's principles to it to help us imagine how we can respond to the kind of devastating understandings that can emerge when we really look at world systems. So I have to thank another great woman, Buddhist, eco-activist, thinker, Stephanie Kaza, for this case study. She's also been writing for decades about Buddhist teachings and practice, and particularly ecological issues. And a couple of years ago, Michael and I attended a conference at which she presented a really powerful workshop or exercise based on the work of a man named Kevin Bales, who wrote this book called Blood and Earth. And it's about modern slavery and ecological destruction, the systemic links between human rights issues and ecological issues. Kevin Bales, who wrote the book, is a journalist and a longtime anti-slavery activist. I should add the connections between modern-day slavery, or 21st century slavery, ecological destruction, and political instability in war-torn parts of the world. These links that also directly link to our consumer culture and our very homes and our very back pockets. So this case history begins with the Earth beneath the surface, a geological system that has produced rare deposits of minerals such as coltan, cassiterite, which is a kind of tin ore, and niobium. I didn't know what coltan or niobium were. I still don't, but they go into electronic devices, is what we need to know. And they're not very widely to be found in the world. But they are found in the Eastern Congo, an area that was left without a functioning system of government and law in the wake of the Second Congo War from 1998 to 2003. The author of the book calls it the world's greatest forgotten war, because it was overshadowed by the events and consequences of 9/11. The Second Congo War was a direct outgrowth of the genocidal conflict in Rwanda in the mid-90s, and the brutal First Congo War between the Hutu and Tutsi refugees who had fled to the Congo from Rwanda. And it's more than I can tackle to trace the details of that devastating history. They're readily available to learn. But religious, economic, governmental, and military systems created interlocking chains of cause and effect that left the Eastern Congo in chaos, the inhabitants victims of militias led by power-hungry warlords. And in the absence of a functioning system of social order, the militias would surround a village at night and take the village by force. And this is Bale's account. When they're looking for territory to grab, the militias first seek out minerals. Then he mentions the ones I just mentioned. He said, all of these are near the surface and easily mined. For years, local people have been supplementing their crops with money earned gathering minerals from streams and along cliffs and fissures. But the armed gangs want much more. They want all the minerals, no matter how deeply they must dig, and they want them now. Once they've pinpointed a desirable area to attack, the militia will surround the village at night, take it by force. They want to catch the villagers at home and prevent them from running away into the forest. If the land around the village has plentiful minerals, the soldiers will just move into the houses, announcing, "We're living with you and you will do as we say." Anyone who resists will be killed. Then the men and boys are put to work digging and hauling minerals. The women and girls also dig and sort stone, do the housework, cook, and suffer regular sexual assaults. This is what 21st century slavery can look like. The people living under these conditions lack the most basic of human support systems: adequate shelter, food, clean water — the water's often terribly polluted by the mining — and health care is virtually non-existent. And in addition to the human suffering of this rapacious greed, fueled by the bottomless demand of our own society, is the damage to the land itself and to the plant and animal ecosystems. This is the area of the Virunga National Park, made famous by Diane Fossey's work with the mountain gorillas, that some of you may have read her books some years ago. It's also the home to a formerly vibrant population of elephants, hippopotamus, buffalo, and antelope. The wanton slaughter of these animals by rogue militia and the encroachment on their habitat by displaced populations has been beyond devastating. Bates gives an example of ecosystem breakdown. The militias slaughtered thousands of hippos to sell cheap meat to the cities. The lake ecosystem, where the hippos had fed on vegetation, collapsed because the supply of hippo dung into the lake no longer nourished the plankton upon which the fish fed, which supported the fishing villages around the lake, making these family villagers vulnerable to being recruited by the militias as slave labor. And then there are the layers and layers of middlemen and transport operations between the rogue mining operations before those minerals are manufactured into electronic devices and sold in retail stores around the world, so that the trail can be very difficult to track. Bales goes into quite a bit of detail describing about 11 links along that supply chain involving varying degrees of corruption. He makes an important distinction between guilt, responsibility, and culpability. So at the far end of the supply chain, Sony and Sanyo, or Best Buy, you know, at the retail level, are not guilty of slavery or ecocide directly, but in not taking responsibility for ensuring that those raw materials are supplied from clean sources, they are culpable. We could say this story ends in our back pockets or our purses or on our desks where our cell phones and laptops keep us at their beck and call. But of course it doesn't end there either. Have you seen the photos of huge, huge piles of electronic waste? Cell phones, tablets, laptops exported to countries like China or even poorer countries like Bangladesh, where often children take them apart to salvage recyclable metals, which are often highly toxic. We're not guilty, but are we culpable? What is our responsibility? When Stephanie Kaza presented us with this scenario, this case history at the conference, she gave us the task of creating schematic maps of these relationships. We got into little work groups and we had to kind of create a representation of these systems. And it was really hard. I remember in my group, there was one guy who insisted on trying to make it a linear cause and effect chain, and it just wasn't that. It was much more complex. How are our cell phones linked to all this? How can we draw this complex web of relationships? I could have used other case histories, other stories of interwoven world systems. He gives examples of enslaved whole families, working in illegal quarries in India, doing hard, hard manual labor to provide the granite for the state-of-art gourmet kitchens everyone seems to want these days. Check where that granite came from. And children working in horrendous conditions on shrimp farms in Bangladesh, which have taken over vast tracts of really valuable wetlands that buffer the effects of rising sea levels and devastating monsoon floods. So here's again that interface between essentially slave labor and ecological destruction. When I read that section about the shrimp farming, I remembered my grade school textbooks assured us that the vast riches of the oceans would feed humankind for hundreds of years to come. They were so confident. And then on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi, horrible religious violence between poor upland farmers who are Christian and relatively prosperous Muslim fishermen and traders on the coast. There's lots of history behind that, but the deep roots in colonial history. But in recent years, this conflict has been inflamed by, guess what? The international demand for cheap chocolate, right? Chocolate as a middle class delight, right? That has apparently boomed in China, you know, and India, the new middle class. Modeled after what we do. So the wealthy Muslim coast dwellers are buying up the farmland of the Christian hill dwellers on the island of Sulawesi. So we could add more case histories. We could add case histories closer to home. We could look at the ecological destruction wrought by the bitumen extraction of in the tar sands and the health effects on neighboring indigenous communities. We could look at the complexities of BC forest industry and conflicts over old growth logging, right? And the systemic links with the issues of indigenous communities who fall in on both sides of the conflict, right? Depending on their own situations. So as I said, right, it can feel really overwhelming to hear these stories of terrible poverty, abuse, and suffering behind the scenes supplying the needs of our consumer society. And that's why Joanna Macy teaches a practice she calls active hope. A lot of people have been talking about hope in recent years, calling it engaged hope, radical hope, intrinsic hope. Roshi Joan Halifax calls it wise hope. So that means hope with eyes wide open, not blind hope, or we could say with our Dharma eye open. We need to be able to see the world as it is, in all its complexity, without that kind of reactive judgment, but with discernment, you know, a kind of clear-eyed discernment, with wisdom and compassion both. This is the first step that Joanna Macy recommends in practicing active hope, is that clear seeing. Really not turning away, seeing the world as it is. And next, to deeply realize that we have choices to make, and that our choices matter, however small they might seem. We can't do everything, none of us can do everything, but we can choose something we deeply care about and do something, join with others who share that caring. And then maybe someone we know will be inspired by our commitment and either join us or do something that they really care about. And we can be glad that they're doing that because we can't do everything, right? But they're doing that. We can be really grateful. So the caring grows and spreads and encourages. And then she says our capacity to respond depends on our capacity to imagine other ways, ways to live in balance with living systems, to exercise restraint in our habits of greed, hatred, and ignorance, to cultivate generosity, caring, and insight. And with that vision, that imagination, then we can choose actions and words and strategies to make a difference. And to fuel that capacity for imagination and vision, we also need to open to and seek out sources of inspiration that encourage and empower us. So that means going beyond the headlines of mainstream media. It means sometimes going to independent or grassroots sources and becoming informed about what courageous and committed people are doing all over the world. So that we're not just looking at the horrific effects of our human greed, hatred, and ignorance, but also how efforts are being made to heal, restore, nourish right relationships. I think it helps to keep a sense of wonder, a real sense of wonder at the beauty and complexity of world systems. Almost a childlike wonder, to be curious, to understand how things work. Because if we can't see how things work well, we can't see how things are going out of alignment and what to do to restore. So we need to look at the beauty of how the world can work and does work. So in this book, which is it's a painful book to read, but he tells also that about people who are doing good work. There's a hospital that's dedicated to treating survivors of sexual violence. He himself co-founded an organization called Free the Slaves that works with multiple systems to free those in bondage labor and support them to rebuild their lives. Many organizations are working so hard to support ecosystem conservation and healing. Closer to home in our own province and in our own country, people are working for indigenous and climate justice, food sustainability, housing, healthcare, from systemic perspectives. And apparently there is an organization called the International Tin Supply Initiative, which specifically works to get that supply chain clean and corporations to commit to making sure their supply chain is clean, coming up from the mine itself and the workers right to us. And he tells some specific countries that companies that rate higher than others, and I would quote him, except that I would like to give you more up to date. His information is already 6 or 7 years old. So I'm not going to do a product placement in this Dharma talk, but that information is available, you know, of who does a better job of supporting the people who do the work on the ground. And we as consumers have collective power to make choices in what we buy and from whom, and to let the manufacturers and retailers know why we are making those choices. We have that power, and it has been shown to work. We can also support the right to repair movement, which pressures companies to make their devices repairable with ordinary tools by people with generic skills, so that devices can be repaired and last longer, not thrown away. And we can resist the temptation to buy the latest, smartest device every other year. So I'll say again, just because you can't do everything doesn't mean you can't do anything. Activating one point of care and connection on Indra's net vibrates the whole net, right? And reverberates. So don't ever, ever think that you are powerless to make a difference in this world. So that's all I'm going to say, because there's so much that could be said, so much more. But I will leave it to you to be curious and wondrous, and learn more without, you know, that kind of unproductive guilt. It's not about guilt. It's about responsibility and care. I'll just add that. Okay, so we'll do what we usually do. Thank you all for listening. What we usually do on a Wednesday evening is invite you to have some share from your own experience and practice. So I'm going to invite you into small groups of about 3, and I'm going to ask you to, kind of think from this systemic perspective about one item that you use in your daily life. It could be food, or it could be a device, or could be chair that you sit on. Just think about what you choose something, and then imagine the supply chain, right? And how complex, what other systems were involved in bringing that to you? And are there some problematic what's problematic in that supply chain, and what could be different? Give that a try. If that's really hard, just respond to what comes up for you when you think on this scale, on this global system scale, and what's your place? How do we take our place on that scale? Okay, so.